Welcome to the Caregiver's Toolbox, tools for everyday caregiving. We provide education and information on senior care topics. Here's your host, Ryan McInniff.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Caregiver's Toolbox, the first episode of 2019, the first of many episodes. My name is Ryan McInniff. I am the host of the Caregiver's Toolbox. I am here with Janet, my co-pilot. Janet, how are you?
I am well. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So to give people a heads up before we get into our discussion is that for 2019, one of the goals was to have more guests on the podcast. And one of those, the way to do that was to have some people call in, as you've heard over the internet, which has had some difficulties where people drop out or the sound recording doesn't sound very good. So part of that, I figured if they were local, they could come in, do some local interviews. And in my, I guess, pea-sized brain, I figured how hard would it be to have three microphones plugged into a computer recording? And that turned out to be much more difficult than I thought it would be. It was talking about upgrading our hardware, upgrading our software. And, you know, I'm kind of the person that I get frustrated with this stuff, but you become intently
determined.
Yeah, you become really intensely determined to make sure that it gets done. So when I said on our last podcast, we'll be reporting a bunch of new podcasts, I figured we'd buy this little new doohickey.
You were trying to land on the dark side of the moon.
Yeah, plug our microphones in, and then we'd hit a button that says record, and all would be well, and this would take maybe 15 minutes of effort, in which it took days and hours of effort to try to figure out all this nonsense. So unfortunately, we didn't really record as many episodes as we had liked. So we'll have to do that in the upcoming week and trying to record and get a backlog of episodes. But that's kind of how we spent our New Year's, was really just me being frustrated about, you know, I think I said, if we, you know, it's the old saying, if we put a man on the moon, how hard is it to plug three microphones into a setup and just have people record? But it didn't turn out to be that easy. And it is what it is. What are you going to do?
But here we are.
So anyway, I think we're on episode 102. We never really mentioned anything for doing 100 episodes. I guess it kind of just was like, what are we going to do? Like, we're going to pat ourselves on the back for 20 minutes about doing 100
horns,
episodes?
Horns, yahoo.
So I thought we kind of just did it. We needed to get through everything. And it is what it is. So anyways, today's topic, that this came up a couple weeks ago, but in mid-December. So it's not really out of date, but it's very relevant. And what we're going to be talking about is hospital closures. And I felt a little bit like I was on a mini spotlight team of one. And for those that don't know, Spotlight is kind of our, like, I'm sure it's a shell of itself with all the newspapers closing and things like that. But for many years, it was like true investigative journalism, deep dive journalism by the Boston Globe. The Spotlight team uncovered the whole Catholic Church mess in the Boston area. That was one of their kind of claims to fame. And they've done a number of other things. I'm sure that list goes much longer than I am aware of. But I say that kind of jokingly because I kept diving in, and instead of having just one news article in front of me, I have three. And so where this started was that I saw an article about elderly in rural areas that have no one to turn to, volunteers are stepping up. And so basically it talks about, and we could go through it line by line if we want, but basically it talks about a lot of people in rural areas in the flyover states of the United States. They're speaking about this one with North Dakota, that volunteers have been taking people on 180 mile round trip visits to go to dialysis, go to hospitals, go to specialists, and The people that are helping out with that are volunteers. And it seems to be a growing issue in many states that we don't have the people to care for the aging population.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's one of those things that I think has been going on for a long time, but it's just kind of coming into its own.
Probably. And they mentioned in this article that it's that basically the volunteers have been logging 89,000 miles a year, up from 76,000 miles a year. And just to put that in perspective, that the federal government, for round numbers, says that every mile you drive on your, if just here, just a side note, you don't value your car by anything but how many miles are on it, meaning that for every mile you drive a car, that's 50 cents out of your pocket. Maybe not immediately, but in the future, between gas, insurance, future maintenance and repairs to operate that vehicle. So when you think about that, that they've been basically, let's just round it up because it's easy math, 90,000 miles. That means that there's, you know, basically $45,000 out of people's pockets to help these elderly folk do get to and from, you know, their specialists. The percentage of family caregivers, unpaid relatives or friends in rural areas fell to 16% in 2015 from 31% in 2009, reports the National Alliance of Caregiving and the AARP Public Policy Institute. So the family, friends and unpaid relatives, the ones that we expect to be doing this, are not the ones that are doing this in more and more cases.
Well, I think in cases, too, where it was family members, there's that whole component of the population aging, and there aren't some of the people there to help, even in terms of family. And I think, you know, you hear about, you know, on a level of China, people that used to grow up in the family work on the farm. Well, now the kids are growing up and they're moving out of the rural areas. So there aren't, the same thing is happening here in that if the, especially like the farmers aren't doing well, the kids are getting other occupations and they're leaving. So there isn't that family structure to help out older folks.
Yeah. And it seemed, and I think that's the case, that people are looking at these towns that are very, you know, the saying is a one horse town, kind of like they're, and they're getting smaller and smaller while cities are getting bigger and bigger. And then, hey, listen, I want to live a life where I have opportunity to meet hundreds of thousands of different people rather than I know the same people from middle school to high school to college, to when you're working, basically, you know, if they go get college educated. But my point being is the people that you met in grade school are still the people that you are in the same town doing the same things come when everybody's 30 and 40 and 50 and 60. And so it says in this article that 65% of areas short of health professionals are in rural and partially rural areas. And about 40% of rural residents live in counties with no public transportation services, which really isn't a surprise for people. So basically what ends up happening is that paramedics and these 911 services end up becoming the transportation services for these elderly folk that can't drive, have no transportation, and if they don't have volunteers willing to drive them, well, they end up calling 911.
Yeah, and even, you know, on a 911 level, all ambulances aren't created equal. In some cases, there are ambulances that, you know, transport people, but in other cases, there are ambulances that these rigs are like little mini ERs, you know, and I think some people think they are all the same. And if you've ever been in one that has all the bells and whistles, you think that's what they've got, and that's not the case.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's an example that I found interesting, that you have a woman named Patty Jo Baker, 67, lives with her husband on a 23-acre ranch in central Wyoming, about 25 miles from the nearest town with a grocery store and a pharmacy. So it's a haul to get to really civilization. Her husband, 69, who worked as a diesel mechanic, was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's 9 years ago after he could no longer remember how to put engines back together. Ms. Baker drove her husband 5.5 hours to Salt Lake City for the diagnosis. Later, they found a neurologist in Jackson, Wyoming, 2.5 hours away, who sees her husband twice a year. So, you know, what do you do?
Yeah.
You live isolated on a farm. You have somebody that has Alzheimer's. I mean, I don't mean to sound judgmental, but my guess is if you're living in Wyoming and you're a diesel mechanic, you probably made a modest living. So you don't have all the money in the world to just get up and leave. And she makes the point that says, you know, she asked her daughters, one 35 miles away and the other 22 miles away, to take turns sitting with their dad for a few hours on the weekend. Her grandson, Bailey, decided not to return to the University of Wyoming so he could help with the ranch and care for his grandfather. One daughter asked her, why don't you move, Mom? Why can't you just move and be closer? I can't do that, she says. She worries the change would make things worse for her husband, who's already losing his way around the house. So, you know, and also these older adults have deep ties to their communities.
It's their purpose. It's who they are.
You know, imagine if you lived on a farm that brought you your income, brought you your food, has probably been passed down in generations, is my guess. I mean, I'm not sure. You know, that would be like, that's a lot of, you know, we talk about people who have trouble giving up things in their house that aren't sentimental. You know, the trash and the crap that hasn't been used in 35 years.
Yeah.
What about giving up the house and the land that you've had in your house for two generations or three generations, and you know, your husband has Alzheimer's, and that's the last thing he knows anymore is how to get around on the ranch.
Yeah, and if you've lived of modest means to move or to move more to a more urban situation, the cost of living is going to be higher.
Absolutely.
And to someone who's suffering from dementia, routine is important, familiarity is important, but it could come to a stage where he's not sure where he is. And she's now living in an area that's totally unfamiliar to her, and it costs a heck of a lot more. And who's to say they can always sell their house?
Absolutely. That doesn't mean that they can even sell it. So anyways, this was part one of my investigative journalism. And by that, I mean just reading articles online. And so what happened was I was sitting there going, well, why are all these closures occurring? I mean, obviously it's money. I mean, we all, you know, we know it's money.
Mm-hmm.
But what's going on? So the New York Times had an article in late October, which, you know, recent enough, I mean, especially with this topic, on a sense of alarm as rural hospitals keep closing. Quote, options are dwindling for many rural families and remote communities are hit hardest. Beyond the potential health consequences for the people living nearby, hospital closings can exact an economic toll and are associated with some states' decisions to not expand Medicaid as part of the Affordable Care Act. Since 2010, nearly 90 rural hospitals have shut their doors. By one estimate, hundreds of rural hospitals are at risk doing so. So, first of all, what's rural? Like, right, you know, is rural, you know, Emerson Hospital is rural.
It's changing. It's
Emerson Hospital, probably 30 years ago, you might have thought was rural, you know, or whatever. You know,
yep.
You know, Emerson Hospital's in Concord, Massachusetts, is about 20 miles away from downtown Boston. So it's not really rural, but is rural outside of 495, which is maybe 40 minutes away from Boston? I don't know what rural means, but obviously, if you imagine, you got to imagine. What's definitely rural is North Dakota. What's definitely rural is the outskirts outside of, you know, the areas between, you know, northern Colorado into Wyoming. Those places that, you know, have the oil rigs on them, have the, you know, are doing farming or oil and gas, or those are very rural areas, I would imagine.
And you think in that rural area, you think what it takes to comply with regulations just in terms of staffing those hospitals. You know, it's not like you've got a bunch of people living in the neighborhood. There's a lot of commuting going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of brings a point that I was going to make here was that a study in the Health Service Research, Health Services research found that when a community loses its only hospital, per capita income falls by about 4% and unemployment increases by 1.6 percentage points. So, you know, and to be fair, and, you know, you have to look at this as objectively as possible. Not all closures are problematic. Some are in areas with sufficient hospital capacity. So, for example, if Emerson was considered rural and it closed, it would be inconvenient, but it wouldn't be devastating, right? So you would go to Leahy, or you'd go to Newton Wellesley, or you would go out to, I know there's a hospital out, you know, in the kind of Fitchburg area, I think. Mm-hmm. There are areas that you could go. It's inconvenient, but it's not outrageous. Where it would be a problem is if you were having an emergency, like a heart attack or a car accident, but I'm talking for general needs. Moreover, in many cases, hospitals that close offer relatively poorer quality care than nearby ones that remain open. This forces patients into higher quality facilities and may offset negative effects associated with the additional distance they may have to drive. What are you going to do? I mean, like, what?
Yeah.
So there's pros and cons to it, right? Like, so maybe this will work out, maybe it won't. But
yeah, and it depends too that, you know, a lot of the little hospitals that are surviving, they've become part of a bigger facility. So they are, you know, a satellite office, if you will. I can remember, and this goes years back, I knew people in Des Moines, Iowa, and there's some major river that runs through Des Moines, and there was a hospital on one side of the river, and there was a hospital on the other side of the river, and they were in competition over who had the faster medical helicopter.
Yeah.
And it was because of getting ranchers, farmers, people like that to the hospitals. You know, it was like...
But, I mean, the side effects are, you know, something published earlier this year found higher risk for preterm births are more likely in counties without those types of hospitals where they're not available for people, which makes sense. You know, what they said was what's left are maternity care deserts in some of the most vulnerable communities, putting pregnant women and their babies at risk. The New York Times wrote about the struggles of rural hospitals. Some doctors responded by noting that rising malpractice premiums have made it, as one put it, economically infeasible nowadays to practice in rural areas.
Yeah, well, I know there's a significant shortage just in this area in primary care physicians, not specialists, but your basic a doctor. And one of the reasons is because they do not get the same kind of a salary as the specialties do, but they still have malpractice insurance, and it's very, very costly.
No, and it's...
That's here. We're in a medical mecca.
Yes, we are. So then this brought me to another one, because when I was looking at, like, hospital closures... Now, this came up when I was looking around the internet and like, hey, what's going on with these hospital closures? And I just found this fact interesting. And I got this from Health Affairs. This was a research article that I think it came out. I think it came out in mid-December, but I'm not sure. But basically, this shows that hospital closures had no measurable impact on local hospitalization rates or mortality rates from 2003 to 2011. They basically, it's a very, very deep, deep article with 30 different pages or whatever. But I'm only going to read from the first one or two because I'm not going to waste my whole day doing this. We identified 195 hospital closures in the United States between 2003 and 2011, and we found no significant difference between the change in annual mortality rates for patients living in hospital service areas that experienced one or more closures and the change in rates in matched hospital service areas without closures. Nor was there a significant difference in the change in all-cause mortality rates following hospitalization.
I think it's like, you know, any report, who sponsored the study?
I don't know.
You know, and where are they coming from?
I don't know who sponsored it, to be honest with you. I don't know who health affairs are. You can go into it. There are people, basically the affiliations, an assistant professor at the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Brigham Women's University. Another person, Paula, is a resident in medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. These are all Boston-based.
Okay.
And then one of the other guys is associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital.
Got that January cough.
Yeah. So clearly these are professors in the Boston-based area that are doing this. Hospital closures, it says, hospital closures may accelerate in coming years as provisions of the Affordable Care Act put increasing pressure on hospital finances, and I do want to get on this. For example, through reductions in the rate of growth in payments for hospital services and reductions in disproportionate share of graduate medical education funding. Whether hospital closures have meaningful adverse consequences for access and patient outcome is unclear. If hospitals that close have a poor record of quality and safety, and if there are better performing institutions in close proximity, patients may be better off seeking care elsewhere. Alternatively, if hospital closures occur in areas with fewer healthcare alternatives, patients may be worse off. So basically what this is saying, and I do agree that the Affordable Care Act has a little bit to do with this, but I think, you know, insurance premiums have a lot to do with it as well. Basically what they're saying is, if this is a good thing if you live in the cities, and this is a bad thing if you live in a rural America, and I mean true rural America. If you live within 50 miles of a city, this is probably a good thing for you, because while it might be inconvenience to have to drive a little bit further to get the surgery or have to drive a little bit further to get a diagnosis, there's a higher chance that it's going to be a successful surgery or the correct diagnosis. What it seems like to me, they're saying that if you live outside of whatever that rate, I just use 50 miles as a random number, whatever that radius is where they have determined that, you know, it's no longer feasible to make a regular commute into a city to do whatever needs to be done in the hospital, then you're in trouble, because you'd rather have a doctor that got a C- in school than have no doctor at all, right? I mean, that's, if those are your two options, I want the guy or the gal that didn't really do a good job, but at least retained half the stuff that they were supposed to retain, rather than somebody that's like, hey, I slept at a Holiday Inn last night and I might be able to do this.
You know? Good point. Yeah.
So it seems like that division between living in a more populated area and the division of living in less populated areas is now going to affect people more. I find it unbelievably difficult to believe that closures of hospitals have not affected mortality rates, unless the majority of those hospitals that have closed are in more densely populated areas where there's other options, and we basically let the free market, if you will, you know, in a way, for lack of a better term, the cream of the crop rises, and like Jack Walsh said at GE, every year cut the bottom 10%, you know, like get rid of it, because they're obviously not doing a good job. And if that's the case, then that's obviously a good thing, because you're getting rid of the hospitals that are not run efficiently and are not run correctly. And I'm sure many of those nurses and many of those doctors will be, they're qualified and they're good, will be employed very quickly at the other area hospitals. But if you're living in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and that was your only area hospital in 50 miles or 100 miles or 150 miles, well, then you're going to be worried about what happens if you get, let alone cancer, but what happens if you're working on the farm and you slash your hand open really badly, or you need, you know, and I'm not talking like just stitches, but like, let's say you're working and then you rip your arm open and you're going to need surgery. Well, how are we going to get to the hospital? You know, it's going to take a 4-hour drive, or we're going to have to pay, you know, hopefully insurance covers the $100,000 air medevac that comes to pick you up.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's interesting because I think the whole picture, at least in my mind, is changing, and how they measure things are changing, because even the big hospitals, the Mass Generals of the world and all, their mortality rates are going up. Why? Because they get the most complicated cases, and a lot of those, you know, they can be magicians and it's still not successful. So there's always been a higher mortality rate in the big city hospitals than the little rural hospitals. But in addition to that, you've got just the general population coming to the hospital is older.
Sure.
And they are in the twilight of their years. So how they measure the success rate and all, you know, you have to wonder. And I agree with you. I think the emergency part of it is, you know, what do you do with the guy that gets his hand caught in the tractor, you know, and there isn't a local hospital there? As far as some of these other things, I can't help but wonder if it, you know, to what degree people are thinking outside the box, meaning outside of the building, the hospital, because, you know, they talk about all the technology and all these remote things, and we're blessed just because of the finances available in our little corner of the world that you hear about telehealth, where the person can dial in and get their blood pressure checked and these other things. And people that suffer from dementia, you know, that's really not a matter of where they're located to get the services if they're connected right. And yet, I think it's a matter of, you know, trying to sustain a building in certain places. You know, they'll close those, but those other things need to take its place.
Sure. And so, you know, the only other thing I wanted to get to was kind of the Affordable Care Act. And while, you know, for many of these rural people that maybe don't have the money to pay for health insurance on their own, you know, to them, the affordable of the ACA is still a net positive. But if the ACA is also, if the ACA is giving you insurance, but is also part of the reason that your rural hospital is closing because, you know, readmissions are a big deal. And if there's some, if the money's getting tighter and more people are getting paid, you know, the concern, the overall concern, or there are many concerns, but one of the concerns with the ACA, right, is that once you start capping on how much a government is going to reimburse a doctor and the specialists and all the way down to the Tylenol pills that you are given while you are in a hospital, then what kind of ripple effect does that have? That obviously means if you can't pay the doctors as much as that you normally would because you aren't making the profits that you normally were making. Maybe you can't reinvest heavily into research and development and growing your hospital and making it bigger and bringing in units that otherwise normally you would never be able to open because you don't have the profits to do that. It also, the concerns are that if you're capping those profits, well then, what happens with those hospitals, maybe the rural ones that are on the edge of saying, hey, listen, I'm living year by year. I'm living mm-hmm. quarter by quarter right now on whether we can make payroll. You know, and we're trying to provide services to people, but the majority of the people that are walking through my door are either on Medicare, Medicaid, or they're on ACA, which isn't giving us the reimbursement rates that having Blue Cross Blue Shield gives us. So, you know, just like anything in life, there's a yin and a yang to things. There's an action and a reaction. So while the Affordable Care Act has done a lot of good things, there are still some negative repercussions that can come from the governments getting more and more involved in day-to-day healthcare needs. So I think that's what this article is also bringing up as well, that it might be a double-edged sword where it's good for some people, but then it might be not as good for other people, and it might cause some issues. And, you know, again, this, you know, when I said to you privately, you know, this study was done from 2003 to 2011. So it doesn't really do a lot. I think the ACA was actually put into law, enacted, and started being rolled out in 2010. So it's not really a study that can say, hey, this is the positive effects. You know, that's right. Just like any type of form of change, whether it's privately done or done through the government, you need 5 or 10 years to figure out if it's been a success or not. And then
what are you measuring?
So I think that will be interesting, that, you know, is that going to be a double-edged sword, that yeah, while we were able to give people health insurance, well, in the rural areas the hospitals closed down because they couldn't make it anymore, that this happened to be the death blow. But then part of you says, well, if the ACA was the straw that broke the camel's back, it was probably going to be something else down the line anyways. Like, is it six in one, half a dozen the other? I don't know. I'm just trying to look at it from all sides of like, hey, this might be the good thing of it, this might be the bad, and was this hospital going to fail anyways because people were moving out of town? Nurses realized that they could make more money if they moved away 150 miles to a major city or the big city in the state. They could make 20-30% more, and all of a sudden, you know, there wasn't enough people to run the hospital as it is. I don't know.
Yeah, there's so many pieces at play. You know, out there, maybe the doctor's seeing a couple people in his practice, when here, for a while, there was the whole uproar that the average visit was 7.5 minutes. And I can remember years ago when my mom took my grandmother to a doctor's appointment, the doctor said, and I quote, "Don't take your coat off, you won't be here that long." You know, and that was to cover the volume. So you've got these, like you say, yin and yang, these totally different things going on. And how does that figure into, what do you measure? Where do you go from here? You know, there's just so much going on.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was just kind of an interesting little bit of a rabbit hole that I went down, that was kind of just like, huh, this is interesting. Well, why this is happening? And then you start reading some studies and you're like, that doesn't make sense. But obviously these people are, I have no reason to, they're reputable. They work at some of the best and brightest hospitals and schools in the country. I don't doubt that the study isn't accurate. There's no reason for me to believe it is inaccurate. But it was just kind of one of those things where you go, that just doesn't sound right. Like, right. That, you know, that doesn't make sense. But again,
just what do they measure? Yeah.
What is 195 hospital? And it might be in that study somewhere.
And you know, it might be interesting to see in the urban areas, you know, what about the homeless population, which is absolutely huge, and what is that costing the big hospitals?
Yeah.
You know, there's your next spotlight investigation.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how deep we dive on the next one. But, you know, it's I think it's going to be a concern moving forward, is that, it is clear in this country that they're the places to be where you want to make money and you want to have good health care are the cities, right? And you know, we're going to have a guest in here we're going to talk a little bit more about finances. But one thing, and this is just personally, we've talked about this in the office and we've talked about it with Gina, on the rising costs of owning a home in the Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
That if you are living within 495, at a minimum, you are paying what, 600 grand at a minimum. And that's probably getting a small little ranch, you know,
pretty much.
You're probably averaging closer to like $750,000, $800,000 if you want to like walk in the door, if you want to even just like have a seat at the table. And if you really want to, you know, my point being is that when's that, we have so many people coming to the city, right? When does the backlash occur where it's like, you know what, I'm out. I'll go figure it out in Fitchburg, or I'll figure it out out in, you know, Leominster, or I'll figure it out over in Manchester, New Hampshire, or Salem, or wherever, Burlington, Vermont. You know, when do people just say, you know what, it's the cost to play at the poker table, the buy-in is way too high, and I'm not going to spend 2.5 hours, 3 hours a day commuting in and out of Boston I got to imagine at some point in time that pendulum's going to swing back and there's going to be a bit of a correction there. I could be completely wrong. maybe in 10 years we'll be sitting here doing a podcast saying, can you believe that just to buy a house in the area that we work in is $1.8 million? Like, maybe that's what's going to happen. I don't know. But, you know, you see that rural, and where I'll bring it back to our podcast, these rural areas seem to be more and more ghost towns. You hear about that. There's less and less people there. There's less and less opportunity there. There's less and less economic opportunity there, as well as just social opportunity there. And people are leaving. It's clear from these articles where, you know, these people lived on a ranch up in Wyoming, and their kids said, I'm not going to work on the ranch. I'm going to greener pastures.
Yep.
Whatever those are to those people. There was some grandkid that was in school, which most people would argue that it wasn't the wisest choice in the world, but it might be the right choice for him. He left school to go work on a ranch.
Yeah, and that was to support the family and the health issue that was going on, right?
So I don't know what's going to, and that brings up, all right, well, how much financial debt does he have from that? And is that ranch going to be able to offset that financial debt?
Right.
All that type of stuff. But, you know, that's the crisis that's going on in a lot of these states of, you know, I'm going to move to California, or I'm going to move to Denver, or I'm going to move to Chicago, I'm going to move to Dallas, I'm going to move to these bigger cities, and we're not going to be dealing with these rural communities. And then all of a sudden the rural communities come to a point where the scale tips, where it's no longer economically viable to have the on-the-go emergency van that drives around providing care, or what. And then all of a sudden it's the volunteers that have to do it. And, you know, I wonder if there's going to be a backlash where people, and maybe it's the next generation, maybe it's not till 20 or 30 years, you know, maybe it's not for a while, that people say, you know what, who wants to live in the big city where it's trashy and it smells and there are all these people? We want to be out in the green pastures where you can breathe fresh air. You can have some chickens and some goats and
and a pony.
And you can have a pony. Janet, with her ever.
My never-ending quest.
We become a billion-dollar company, Janet. I'll buy you the pony.
Thank you.
But, you know, maybe there will be, I don't know if that backlash will ever happen. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, and as you say, as cities grow, the bedroom communities grow, and it pushes out and out and out. And then those change. You know, towns like Framingham, Massachusetts, you go back, I guess it's like 15, 20 years, it was such a bedroom community. It was so huge. They had two high schools.
Yeah.
Now there's only one high school. And that's because the people from that bedroom community that were feeding the city have kind of migrated further out because they, you know, just economic reasons. So you just, it's like follow the money kind of thing, you know, that line applies in a lot of cases.
Absolutely. So anyways, that kind of wraps up what we were talking about. This is our first podcast of 2019. We appreciate you all listening in. And we will be getting back onto our regular schedule of putting out 2 to 3 podcasts per week. Our goal is to have a lot more guests, some in the studio, I was going to say, some in the office, some not in the office. You know, the only thing that stinks about remote guests is that sometimes the audio quality isn't as good. And when you have a podcast, the only thing that really matters is the content of the podcast and the audio quality. So if you're willing to deal with it and listen to them, if, you know, there's those issues, then we'll work forward, but we'll try to get people in. We really do appreciate you listening. I hope you had a great holiday and a great New Year's, and we will get this train back up and running.
There you go. It's going to be a good year.
Thanks, Janet.
Take care.